Welcome back to the Better Know a Lawyer podcast. This week I'm speaking with Jeff Cohen. Jeff Cohen's an extremely experienced Seattle criminal defense attorney. He's been practicing for 55 years. He does complex felony work and felony sex crimes. He talks about his work in investigating cases. It's a great interview, and I look forward to sharing it. Welcome back. This is the Better Know a Lawyer podcast. I am Noah Weil, and today I'm joined by attorney extraordinaire Jeff Cohen. Jeff, thank you for making it to your house where we're recording.
Okay. I don't know about extraordinaire, but I appreciate it.
Okay. Well, why don't you tell us, Jeff, just a little bit about your history. I think you've been practicing for, 130 years?
Something like that. It's 37 years. Started practicing at the Public Defenders down in Lane County, Oregon, Eugene, and practiced there for a while before moving up here. I've been a criminal defense lawyer the entire extent of the entire time I've been an attorney. I've been practicing up here since 1981. Took a sabbatical in early 90s. Went off to Micronesia, worked as a public defender there, actually, for a couple of years. Came back and have resumed my criminal practice, private practice, and I've been doing it ever since. So the focus of my practice has covered everything from death penalty work down to traffic cases. And for the last, 20 to 25 years, the practice has been focused in largest part, at one point almost exclusively actually, on sexual assault cases. But now the largest part of my practice is sexual assault and domestic violence cases. So,
is it safe to say you're known as one of the experts in those kinds of cases in the city?
I don't know that I use the word expert, but I think people think I'm very experienced there, and I think it serves my clients well that I've been able to focus my practice in large part in that area.
Is it safe to say that I've come to you for advice before, and I've very much appreciated your excellent advice on these kinds of cases?
Well, you would know if you've appreciated it, but yes, we've had the opportunity to work together, and in fact, you second chaired one case more than even second chaired it that we did a three and a half week trial, sexual assault trial together, and we've worked together on various occasions. And actually, I think I was originally your mentor. Through the Washington Association of Criminal Defense Lawyers.
I think you're still my mentor. Jeff.
Oh, there you go. Okay.
A lot of respect for you. I appreciate you taking the time today and sharing your wisdom with the audience.
And I'm happy to share what I know.
And the subject I want to talk to you about today is witness interviews.
Okay.
I know we can talk about a lot of different things, but sure. I think witness interviews is something that civilians don't understand too well.
Okay.
The process of it, why they occur. And so I know it's pretty basic, but it's also very common in criminal cases. So that's what I'd like to talk to you about today.
Okay.
So the first question is, why do defense attorneys do witness interviews?
Well, you know, people often think of trials as being what you see on television and that, you know, it's all extemporaneous, that it's happened, that the question's being asked for the first time. But the reality is we learn that you should never ask a question at a trial that you don't already know the answer to. And this is the mechanism by which you come to learn what it is a witness, how a witness is going to testify. There's a difference, for instance, between federal court and state court, but in our court system, in the state court system here in Washington, we have what's known as open discovery. And that is the state has to provide you with all the police reports and give you the names of all the witnesses that you're going, you know, that they anticipate calling in the course of a trial. And then you have the opportunity in advance of the trial to interview those folks. And if they won't talk to you they have the right to have a prosecutor present if they want. But oftentimes you can approach them and talk to them, find out what they have to say. And in fact, if they're unwilling to talk to you, if they're not willing to do it with a prosecutor present under any circumstance, then you can go to the court. You can get take their depth. You know, it's one of the few places in a criminal case where we get to take a deposition, and the court would order their deposition and say they're material to the case, they're important witnesses. It would be a failure of justice if they were not subjected to an interview. And so then you get to, but you get to interview them, and you get to ask them basically what it is that you anticipate they'll be testifying about, and to ask them questions that arguably you think will help to undercut their own testimony.
So I want to talk to you about different kinds of interviews for different kinds of witnesses.
Sure.
But before then, why not just rely on the police reports?
Well, you know, first of all, police reports are, it's you'd like to think they're accurate. You'd like to think that they're that they accurately reflect what a witness has to say. But clearly, the the police, as they're interviewing an individual, they have a bias, and they're going to want to get the information that helps the state's case. But it may be that they misunderstand. It could be they're mistaken about what the person said. It could be that they've limited the interview to those things that are helpful to the state, but the individual may have additional information which is actually helpful to the defendant. And so the only way you're going to find that out is by interviewing the witness. And the other part is you need to, I think, as important, if not more important, is figuring out how is that person going to come across when they're being questioned. Do they come across as unbiased? Are they coming across, in fact, as having an axe to grind? And the only way you're going to figure that out is to sit there and actually interview them. Like I said, the other part of it is they may well have information that nobody has thought about that's helpful to the defendant. And the only way you're going to do that is spending the time to interview them.
And courts have said that if you don't do any investigation, it's ineffective assistance.
It is. Practice. That's right. The case would be reversed, arguably, on what's called a person restraint petition, or it's akin to an appeal in some ways. But you have an obligation to interview them. And in fact, the courts have gone so far as to say that on occasion, you need to interview the person face-to-face. It's not enough to just do it over the phone. You need to see how they come across, and you can't necessarily do that over a phone. So not every case, not every witness, but I think in certain circumstances, it's imperative that you interview the person face-to-face.
Okay, so let's talk about the first category of people to interview, which is police officers.
Okay.
What are you thinking when you're sitting down to an interview with a police officer? Do you have a sense of the tone of the meeting or what you're trying to accomplish? Because unlike a lot of other witnesses, you have a full report written by them.
Right.
But also they're professional witnesses, essentially.
Right.
So how does that affect how you go about doing the interview?
Well, I think every case is different. You have a flavor for it, perhaps, in the context of the police report and how it's been written. Some officers are going to be very candid with you, and others have an agenda, and they know where they want to go with it. They know they want to, they're working for the state, and they're trying to, they want to do whatever they can to strengthen the state's case. My experience is that when I'm talking to police officers, it's important at the beginning, at least, to give them the opportunity to lay out what it is that's in the report, to get them talking. The same way they try to get a defendant talking, you want them talking. And then what I like to do is begin to focus on the things that I think are that may or may not be that may not be in the report, haven't been fleshed out. And I try to do it as non-confrontationally as I can at the outset. And then if the interview starts to go away where it becomes apparent to me that they have the agenda, then to call them on the agenda and to start to question them in a way that they're aware that I know that what they're saying is biased, but I don't ever call them biased. But let them know this is not as if I'm not observing what it is that they're doing. And hopefully that reins them in a little bit. Sometimes, if nothing else, what it does is the purposes are severalfold, and one of them is to gather the information, to know what it is that they're going to be testifying to a trial, but to know as well how they're going to testify a trial. How are they going to come across to a jury? And sometimes, if you can if you can get them in the course of the trial to be, or rather in the course of the witness interview, to start to show the prickly side, to show the biases, that when you get to the trial and you start to question them, you can be the nicest person in the world, and they're going to come across, they're going to remember the interview, and they'll be aggressive, perhaps, in the way they deal with you, and that will serve you at the trial itself. So it's one of those things that you have to read as you're going along. I think that's part of the practice of any witness interview.
Yeah. I'll just say for the people listening, Jeff is a dog. He's not himself shaking really fast or chewing on a tennis ball. He's the dog in his house. He's doing
the dog is rubbing her back on the ground there.
Yeah. But you're sitting in a chair.
I am sitting here quietly. Yeah. That's
It'll probably be picked up, but that's fine.
Okay. The, it's the best thing that you can have happen in a trial is to have one of the state's witnesses come across very aggressively toward you. Then you just sit there, you ask a question, they overreact to it. Your question was delivered nicely, but if in fact they behave as if they remember how you were treating them at the trial, you just sit there and take it, and juries are offended by it. Juries are bothered by that. So there's that component to it too.
There was a story a while back from a defense attorney trying to set up an interview with a police officer, and the police officer said, I work for the prosecution, my goal is to get your client convicted, and I'm not going to do an interview with you, and also I want him to go down, basically.
Right.
And everyone was shocked by that, because it's probably what police officers believe, at least some of the time, but to say it so overtly that I'm incredibly biased was unusual.
And then you can bring that up at the trial. You can ask them the question, well, do you remember I wanted to interview on that occasion? Do you remember that this is your response? Was, I work for the prosecution. I do. I want your client to go down. Juries want to believe that police officers are unbiased. That's what we have our own natural biases, and we'll establish that. We start off with this notion of officer friendly. The police officers are our friend. It's the way we're sort of raised. So we want to believe that they're out there trying to really get, to be fair and unbiased.
To investigate.
And to the extent an officer wants to hand you something like that from a criminal defense perspective, that's a wonderful piece of information. Can you imagine how taken aback a jury is to hear that this is not an unbiased person, that they have an agenda from the get-go?
Do you think that culturally, the idea that the police officers are independent and professional and serve the public is changing a little bit with the stories of Black Lives Matter and things of that nature?
And the videos that we're seeing nowadays.
Especially.
Absolutely. The police officers start with they have the three, they'll have some statement about serve, protect, defend, whatever those are. Mm-hmm. And it comes across, it's pretty high level. Those are lofty things. But then in reality, it's something very different.
And not all the time.
No, absolutely
not. But we're seeing more examples of police deviating from that.
And it's more often than, were it not caught on video, then I don't know that we would be inclined to, the fact of the matter is we are inclined to believe the police officer who comes in wearing the uniform, who says your client did this or behaved this way. And I think that we're beginning to add, I think that is not as much of a given anymore. I think people are open to suggestions now that maybe the officer's not as unbiased as they're portraying themselves.
I interviewed Officer Eric Mitchell a while back.
Sure.
And he's an officer who,
sure,
and would agree that if he wrote down the report, that's what happened. There's no...
I believe that to be true.
No varnish or anything.
Right.
And we were talking, and I told him it seems so rare to have an officer who's just seems very objective and just wants to report the facts and let the lawyers and the jury do with it what they will.
Mm-hmm.
And it does seem to be that a lot of police officers do have that agenda. And I'm curious if you think that's people who are attracted to the force or part of their training or part of the groupthink in the police academy or the
I think it's, I think there's, the system is it's a polarizing system, and it's...
good guy, bad guy kind of thing?
Yeah, and they come to it with a, yes, I think that's right. And I think that it becomes even more so as time goes on. It's us against them. And I think Eric, for instance, is a great example of somebody who has not bought into that and has maintained this wonderful, unbiased attitude towards things. I mean, quite frankly, I can remember a case years ago where when Eric finished testifying and was walking away from the stand, my client stood up and shook his hand. And the jury was, I think, taken aback. We were very fortunate. It turned out very, very well. But Eric wasn't invested in the outcome. And that's it. You do your job, you do it well. Alan Dershowitz wrote a book called The Best Defense years ago, one of his first books. And he laid out the 10 rules, they were 10 observations that he had. And one of them, and I think it was hyperbole, but one of them was all police officers lie. That was rule number 2 or 3. And rule number 4 was all judges and prosecutors know rule number 3. I don't think it's that bad, but I can tell you from my own experience that there seems to be something inherent in the process that makes it so that officers are willing to, that they get involved in it, that they're not just relating what they know. I used to teach at the academy in Oregon. I would go down with some other public defenders who did this, and we would train police officers. We would teach them how to testify, how to look at how to look at the jury, how to talk to the prosecutor and answer questions. And what astonished me, and I can't account for it. I don't know what it is outside of they become invested in the good guy, bad guy, situation. This was all made up. We would be questioning them about made up things. And every once in a while, they would start to lie or to say something. He goes, this is made up. Why are you doing that? Yeah. But it was reality. And I think criminal defense lawyers recognize that reality. I don't know if I think prosecutors do, but they sort of deny that's there. They don't want to.
Probably depends on the prosecutor.
I think that's true too. But the one, if you have to decide as a juror whether you're going to believe the police officer or you're going to believe the defendant,
the instruction, what's their motivation to lie?
And it's, I think it's jurors are inclined to believe a police officer. It's one of the reasons that it's so hard to prosecute police officers for offenses.
I'm not here to bash police officers. Sure. And I can think from my experience, and maybe yours is different, but from my experience, the majority of police officers are pretty straight shooters. Not all. I can think of examples. I'm sure you can. But going back to the interview stuff, when you're doing these interviews, you kind of have an opportunity, right? You can get information, but you can also maybe present your client's side of the case and get the officer on your side and thinking, oh, maybe this guy isn't as guilty as I thought, which could help you down in trial.
That could happen. I think that, my experience is that doesn't happen very often, though. My experience is that if you start to give them that side of it, they'll tell you all the reasons that doesn't hold up. And it may even be human nature. I don't want to trash them either. I think that, what officers do is, they're the ones who will take a bullet. I appreciate that. They do some wonderful things. Having said that, or they may also send the bullet.
Well, I'm just reminded of a story. When I did a ride along in law school, an 8-hour shift with an officer. And in the second half of that, there was a report of shots fired. And the officer's like, well, we got to go over there. And I'm like, I think we should go the other way. It seems like we shouldn't go into the firefight. But he's like, no, of course. I mean, I was kidding a little bit, but I was like, yeah, that's where the danger is. We've got to go there. And I was like, wow, you guys are really brave and impressive.
I think I don't think that there's nothing as black and white. That's the other part of this. There are officers who are absolutely stupendous. We've talked about one that we both know, but there are, I think, I would imagine the majority of officers, I'm guessing, I don't know the numbers, but I would think that you don't go into that field, you don't go into that profession without a willingness to do those lofty things, to serve, to protect, etc. But it's also, I think it's a system where they may be seeing the same people again and again, and I think they may become jaded and cynical. And I think that's human nature. So it's not that I want to fault them for it, but I think it's what you're fighting. you have to deal with that. And so when you're interviewing the officers, recognize just because they say it's a certain way doesn't mean that that's in fact the way it is. The fact that they wrote it a certain way, we both know that in certain situations, the police reports that we get are cut and pasted. We've seen examples where it's the exact same, where they've actually accidentally left in the name of the person from another case.
Pronouns are a common thing, he versus she.
Right. Yeah. And so those exist. And your job is at the very least, your job as a criminal defense lawyer is to question and to test that officer's testimony, to ask the questions that lead you, if nothing else, to know how they're going to come across on the witness stand. It also lets you know whether it's a case that, it helps you decide how you're going to proceed with the case. Because the vast, vast, vast majority of cases don't go to trial. That's the nature of our system. We couldn't accommodate it if everybody went to trial. I don't know what the numbers are, but I think the large, in fact,
I know
extremely
federal,
large
I know federal, percent. It's 98%.
Well, that's federal court. I think the state's not there, but it's in the range of it's in the range of 90 or something, I think, for the state that are resolved by way of a negotiated plea.
Yeah.
So that the only way you're going to figure out whether you have a defense, how strong the state's case is by interviewing the witnesses.
So let's move to another category,
sure.
Which is civilians, maybe
okay.
The victim in a domestic violence case, the alleged victim,
mm-hmm.
or a literal witness who saw something occur. How does your interview process change with this person who's not a professional with the criminal justice system?
I'm not sure how different it is outside of police officers are trained. And they're trained. They're professional witnesses. As I said, I've trained them before, so they've been taught how to divulge information, how not to divulge information. The layperson is less sophisticated in that respect, less experienced, and so police officers will vary, depending on the police officer, obviously, but. A lot of police officers say, I don't want to talk to you unless I have the prosecutor present. Civilian witnesses don't necessarily know to do that. And I say to know to do it. They may not understand. We can explain to them. They may be perfectly willing to talk to us. And when you talk to them without a prosecutor present, you may be able to get more information from them without a prosecutor present. Sometimes, though, you actually want to have the prosecutor present. If you think that this witness is going to be a really, really bad witness for the state, you think that you really have a lot you're going to be able to accomplish, you may want the prosecutor to see that, to recognize that that they have problems with their case. With a victim of, domestic violence victim, a lot of time, that sort of raises the issue of, are they, so often they are not looking for the case to proceed. Police officers do, but lay people may not. It may be, if it's especially a domestic violence case, obviously some they want it to go forward and some they don't.
And it's not always DV. It could be a property crime that they don't, or trespassing. They just don't want to come to court.
Don't. And you may have the opportunity to find a resolution other than you may be able to ask questions of a witness, of a lay witness, which will assist you in figuring out an alternative resolution to it. So, for instance, if it's a property offense, you're certainly welcome to talk to them about something called a civil compromise. It's a mechanism it's authorized by the system where the damages are paid for and the case is dismissed. And you can have that kind of conversation with a witness that you may not be able to. There's that part of it. You may find that in talking to the folks, you find that what they really want, for instance, is that the defendant get help for whatever it is they perceive to be the problem. So it could be that you can structure a resolution along the lines of what's called a stipulated order of continuance, a treatment-based alternative, and that the case would be dismissed at the very end of all the treatment. That may be what the person wants. And so you can have that kind of conversation, which is something other than a conversation about just the facts of what happened. So that's an important part of the interviewing process. It's also good to know whether they are, whether this person, you know, wants your client strung up and never allowed of jail. That's something you're only going to find out in the course of the interview. That's not going to be in the police reports or the statement they gave to the police.
And something you said about police officers, but I think it's especially true of civilians, is how aggressive they'll be towards you or how prickly they'll be.
Absolutely.
When people asking questions.
When I'm, you know, oftentimes when I'm doing, first of all, when we do an interview, the rules are, the rules say that we really need to have an investigator present. We can't be doing it by ourselves without an independent witness who can testify should the person testify, should the witness say something different than we told you. When they get into the trial, if they should say something different, you need to be able to put a witness on and say, no, you asked the, you know, this is what they said at the earlier point in time. And so you always have, I always have an investigator present. To me, it's not even sufficient to be recording it. Even if they agree to be recorded, I want to have a live witness who can document, you know, can provide information about that. But one of the things that I do with the interviews is I often let the investigator start the interview. And my investigators that I'll work with, I try to pair them up with the case so that they, you know, every case is a little bit different, and I might have a female, I might have a male investigator. But when I let them start the interview, they may start very, the questions may be innocuous, they may be very, there's no judgments in the questions, and let them go for a lot of the questions, and then I'll do some follow-up, and my style is going to be different. I'm an East Coaster, I have a, my edges are a little sharper, probably, perhaps. And so it gives me the opportunity to see what approach is going to get the most information at trial, if we end up in a trial. And again, as I said, it's I can think of a couple of cases where my approach to them in the course of the defense interview was such that when we got to trial, this person, they didn't care for me, didn't like me. I'd ask some probing questions, and they came across very, very aggressively. And I've had jurors later on afterwards say to me, we didn't like the way that person treated you. You know, we always tell our clients when they're taking the stand, you don't want to get into a fight with the prosecutor. And here, in fact, they are, they have, you know, here's their witness getting into a fight with me. And again, that's something that you've set up in the course of the defense interview. Sounds very Machiavellian that, you know, that it's all the, you know, that you're manipulating, but it works. It's been effective. It's been effective. Okay.
And so the next category is experts. Things like nurses who have done a blood draw or DNA analysis or something along that who's highly technical.
Right.
How do you approach those kinds of interviews?
Well, first thing, before you get to those interviews, and as I say, it goes for every case. You don't just walk in and say, tell me what happened. You need to know the material upside down and inside out before you interview, whether it's a police officer, a private person, or an expert. But when you're interviewing their expert, you need to have done all your work beforehand so that you can ask the questions that so that you know where the problems are in their
methodology.
in whatever they've done. And whatever they're called upon, you know, to testify about, that you know where the weaknesses are in that story so that you can ask them about those things. Mind you, you're showing them the weaknesses, but if the weaknesses are weaknesses that can't be remedied, that they, you know, that they're weak on it, they may give that to you. Again, it helps the prosecutor know, it helps you show the prosecutor there's some weaknesses with it. The other part, again, you're going to know it's going to show you how they're going to come across in front of a jury. But it allows you to talk. It allows you to identify the areas that your expert is going to need to address. Because that's the second part of it. If they have an expert witness, you may have an expert witness. And your expert needs to know specifically what the, you know, what it is their expert is testifying to. And so that your expert, if your expert disagrees, you know, sees a fallacy in their argument, in the state's expert's testimony, it gives them the opportunity to look at the thing in a fashion that they can bring to the courtroom the stuff that's going to show the shortcomings of the state's expert's witness.
Do you bring an expert to the interview?
I haven't, but I've consulted with them in advance, mm-hmm. so that they can tell me what it is. I have never done that. I haven't had the occasion to do it. And the state has fought it, I know, in other cases. But it is a place that people have done it. They've brought, for instance, where the interview of a child in a sexual assault case is done by your expert witness, who can ask the kinds of questions that are, you know, that are going to highlight or identify the problems with the child's ultimate testimony.
How often do you find these experts have their own agenda, like police, that are very prosecution friendly? Or, you know, they could be scientists, subjective, and they do the lab tests and put the beakers where they're supposed to be.
Well, it's, you know, I just finished interviewing a couple of the state's expert witnesses on DNA, two different kinds of DNA experts, in a case that I'm going to try here shortly. And my experience is such, and I didn't mention it before, but my background is actually biochemistry when I was in college and grad school. So here are people that, I mean, I understood what the issue was. I knew what we were talking about. I was familiar with it. I've actually had to go again. I've had to deal with these two experts before. And they were markedly different. One of them, I think of as a real scientist. When he talks, when I talk to him and ask him questions, he's very, very straightforward with me. He acknowledges the problems that exist with his testing and also corrects me if I'm pushing too far on something. And I think he makes a marvelous witness in front of the jury. It's helped me, but at the same time, in the previous case it helped me, but at the same time it's the jury finds him credible. Mm-hmm. Whereas the other witness is less so. Her agenda becomes clear. She's fighting me on everything. And I think ultimately, in fact, my last trial that I had to deal with her, it was the male DNA expert who undercut her testimony, the other expert's
and
testimony.
They were both state's witnesses.
They were both state's witnesses. So it's, I think that it works to your, I think there are some who have agendas, some who don't, and it's the ones who don't who the juries ultimately find most credible. I can think of a case, I'm thinking the case that we had where we tried it together where the state's expert, one of the state's nurses, answered a question about the way, whether or not you could end up with contamination by the way that somebody wipes after using the facilities, and they were unwilling to give me the most basic, to acknowledge the most basic concept. I don't want to sound gross, but you know, the notion of we teach our children to wipe from, you know, in one direction, that's it, from front to back, instead of back to front. And she wouldn't acknowledge that, and I think she lost credibility in front of the jury. I don't remember that.
I do remember. And
we talked about it in closing argument. But come on, that doesn't make any sense.
Yeah.
We used to have this.
Wish the case went better. But
no, I appreciate that too. But you know, it used to be this. We had this. King County had this absolutely wonderful medical examiner, Dr. Ray.
Mm-hmm.
And Dr. Ray was. I can remember a case that I had. Went to trial ultimately, but the state was contending that this belt that my client was when he was arrested, that this was the belt that left the certain marks on the child's. On a child's buttocks, because the child had been slapped or strapped. He'd used his belt supposedly as a strap and left some marks on the child's buttocks. And the state was trying to say, "This is the belt that caused these. That would have tied my client to the crime." And I remember going to Dr. Ray, who was I think he was still working as the state's medical examiner. So here he was, employed by the state. He was King County's medical examiner. And I showed him the pictures of the pictures of the belt and the pictures of the strap, of the markings on the child's buttocks. And I said, what's your perception of this? Is this the belt that caused this? And he looked at it and said, that belt didn't cause those. I said, would you testify about that? He said, tell the state Dr. Ray is coming to testify for the defense because he's a scientist. And science is science. It's not subject to which person is calling you. And I think that when expert witnesses, when they start to show an agenda, when they're not just testifying about science, that's when they lose their credibility. And I think that's, in the course of the defense interview, your job is to figure out and to be able to show, is there an agenda that's
here? Do you think the juries pick up on that?
I do. I think that, you know, it's not nice, but we talk about defense whores or prosecution whores. You know, we can go out and we can hire experts who are going to give us, we know what they're going to say beforehand. And maybe sometimes they cancel each other out. But if you're getting down to a battle of experts, the person who comes across as not having an agenda, the person who comes across as testifying straightforwardly is the person the juries are going to like. And I think that's ultimately what you want. The jury has to like the individual. The jury, they have to be credible. They have to be believable. You know, unfortunately, some people can come across credibly even when they're testifying about nonsense. But I think that you stand a better chance of having a jury like the person, like your witness, if the witness comes across as not having an agenda, not being biased. You know, I can think of another case that I had, I tried up in Jefferson County with I called an expert witness, and there were two experts. There was their expert. Their expert didn't come across as seemed to be wanting to fight me at every turn. And then when my expert got on the stand, she was so credible. Just, I was able to, you know, she would give it up where she needed to give it up. She was, you know, she wasn't going to take positions that were, you know, unreasonable. And when she finished testifying, the judge asked if it would be okay if we excuse the jury for a moment, and then asked if she would be willing to come and testify in front of all to teach the rest of the judges about such a thing.
That's a nice thing in the middle of a trial.
It was a wonderful thing, and it should have let the prosecutor know they were going to go down in flames. But the largest, as I'm convinced, the reason that the jurors loved her, the reason the judge liked her, was because she didn't take positions that were, you know, that were just going to be one-sided, and that she was not open to whatever the, you know, to those places where there were weaknesses in her argument, she gave them up.
This is a little bit off topic, but I've seen in trial some lawyers, when there's an expert on either side, some just get down to like the core issues, like disregard everything else, but there's this one problem you have, and I want to address it. And then others kind of bury the jury in just minutiae and just science. And especially with your background, I'm sure with the DNA people, you could have them talking for days about tiny helixes and whatever else. do you have a feeling on what's more effective?
Oh, I think ultimately that you don't want the jurors' eyes to glaze over. You need to be talking in lay terms. In fact, it's not just in terms of expert witnesses that happens. Police officers, when the police officer starts talking about the perp or starts talking in those terms that are very formalistic legal terms, it removes the jury. Always, I want to be talking in lay terms. And so I will purposely, I know it'll sound like I'm being manipulative, but I'll trip over words almost purposely sometimes because jurors don't understand those words. And I want them to understand, it's important that everything come down to, to some place that they can hopefully understand it. It needs to be made as simple as possible. What do they say? KISS, keep it simple, stupid. That's the...
Well, I mean, it is manipulative, but it's also persuasive, and our jobs are persuasion.
I think so. I know so. I mean, that's right.
So I don't think it's a sin to be effective at persuasion.
No. I think that it's, you know, ultimately sometimes jurors just, they have a set, you know, they have a sense. I don't expect a jury to truly understand, you know, you bring some expert in who's been, you know, has a PhD in such and such, you can lose a jury if all you're doing is talking the minutiae. Help us understand the job of what you want to do with your expert, what you want to do, even if you're using their expert, is you want them to educate the jury. Educate, don't pontificate, you know, bring them along, help explain, talk to them about, help us understand this part or that part. And to the extent you can make it as, you know, make it simple and reduce it to pretty simple terms, I think you're going to be more effective.
Okay. The last category of people to interview, I think, is the most controversial, children.
Right.
Something especially in your line of work, dealing with children in sex cases.
Right.
You know, a lot of defense lawyers will never need to interview a kid, just their DUIs or something. It's just not going to come up. So it seems to me that it's a specialized thing. And I'm not even talking about people in high school. We'd think of them as children, and their brains aren't fully developed like grown-ups. But I'm talking like 12, 10, 9, 8, 7, 5. So what are your thoughts on that when you're doing an interview with a child?
I think, you know, I think you try to be as gentle and as pleasant. And this notion that you see on television, again, of browbeating a child, that is, I think, incredibly ineffective. I think it does not serve your client in any way. I think the most effective thing you can have is to be able to interview the child so that when and if you end up in a trial, that when you're sitting there talking to the child in the courtroom itself, that you can talk to them and say things like, do you remember when you and I met, the first time we met, and you remember we met over there and it was in a room and it was, I think you were wearing that, I was wearing this, and we talked about something, do you remember that? And I think it's gentle. It's gentle, it's gentle, it's gentle. And ultimately, I think you'll get much more information than if you're a little aggressive. I think in my career, I know of one situation where I did something. I felt compelled to be aggressive in the course of an interview with the hope that it would go a certain way. And it did work out that way. But personally, I didn't want to do it. It felt terrible, but it was my obligation to do that. Having said that, I think I've gotten much, much farther in being able to talk to a child. Just like you talk as much as possible as if you're talking to your own children. I think that the more you can get, you can sit with a child in a way that you're in a chair, you're drawing, you're having them draw pictures, you're having them do the things that they're comfortable with, you're more likely to get the kind of information that you want that'll assist you later on in trial. I can remember in the prosecutor's office, there used to be the place, the room where they would interview the children, where their quote-unquote witness, what they call the child interview specialist, they would interview them at a little table and almost little chairs. And I was perfectly happy to sit in those chairs or to sit on the floor and interview, you know, talk to a child at that level. I think if you bring the child into a big room and they have to sit in a big chair and they're looking, you know, they're uncomfortable and they're not going to talk. You're going to get much less information. If you can get down on the ground, you can talk to them. You're drawing while they're drawing. I think you're going to be much better off. You're more likely to get the information you want.
How often do you see a guardian of a child? The child might be a victim in a case or alleged victim. How often do you see a child where the guardian has, you know, terrified them? Oh, the defense attorney is going to talk to you and he's going to try to trick you and all this stuff.
I always ask the question, you know, why, you know why you're here? Who brought you here today? What have you been told about what we're going to do today? what about questions I'm going to ask you, trying to get their input, you know, or not input, their whatever information they have, and get that all on the table. I don't get that they're going to try to trick you. I haven't heard that much, but you know, that's they're gonna want to talk to you about such and such. What you want to do is you want to gather as much information out. To what extent they've been prepped for this, so they know to what extent has someone let them know what the story is, even sort of in a, not having told them specifically what to say, but have given them the clues so they know what it is that I'm going to be asking them about, so they know what story to be telling them.
A script,
yeah. It's something that lets them know you need to be talking about the story that you told the police. They're going to ask you the same questions that the police asked you, those kinds of things.
Do you deviate from the police questions just to try to trip up the script?
I try very hard not to have them just, I'll have them tell me about what happened, but I'm not using the police script. I'm listening carefully to what they're saying. I think the interview process, whether it be with police officers or lay people or experts, I want to listen to what the person is saying to me and react, ask the questions based on the specifics of what they've told me. If it's it may be that there's a detail that they tell me that they relate this time that wasn't in the police report, and I'm certainly going to want to relate. You know, I want to focus on that and get the conversation going in a different direction. I don't care. You know, I'm not interested in what you've told anybody else. I pretend I don't know anything. Let's talk about what happened. Let's talk. You know, sort of move that other script out of the way if I can. You know, again. Every single case, every single alleged victim, everyone, every time it's different. And you can't deal with it. That one, it's not one size fits all. You have to be flexible. You have to be willing to move in a direction that they give you. It's not unlike you can write out your closing argument, you can write out what you're gonna do at trial. You can write out the script, but you also have to be open to changing the script completely.
And I think that's an interesting difference between cross and interviews. In cross, you have a pretty rigid script, and sometimes they'll give you answers, and that'll lead you down a path, but sometimes it's a trap. And if you start letting them dictate the questions, right. You can get a bad answer.
Right.
But in interviews, you can pick and choose what you want to use at your trial and your cross, and you might as well explore every avenue.
I believe that'd be true. I think that you make a mistake if you think that if I sort of tiptoe around in the interview and don't go address the difficult stuff, that somehow or another that's gonna serve you down the road. You want to know the worst thing. You want to know everything that they have that they stand to, you know, to hurt you at trial with, to use against your client at trial.
Makes sense.
So. You might as well, this is your opportunity to explore it. This is your opportunity to find out the specifics. And if it's if they testify differently at trial, then you've got it. Then you've addressed it at least. Do you remember when you told me back on that date, such and such? And
yeah. Well, Jeff, that was the questions I had about witness interviewing.
Uh-huh.
Really important part of the defense lawyer's toolbox. And you went into great detail. And thank you for sharing your... What was it, 200 years?
Yeah.
200 years of wisdom with us for that. So, Jeff, thank you for being here. I hope we can talk to you again about some other subjects. You really have a lot of interesting things to say.
Been my pleasure. Thank you.
But for now, this is Noah Weil signing off.